Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day.
Fact.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I can tell you've had a second cup of coffee this morning, Cyrus. You're all over those buttons.
Yeah, I'm having fun.
People are seeing you on Twitter right now. I posted a picture of Cyrus.
That's not me.
That is you.
It's not me.
Who else could it be? During the Patrick Madrid Show, no one else is allowed.
That's old Thomas.
In the... Oh, we got to get a picture of young Thomas. Let's do... At the next break, I'll get a picture of young Thomas. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show, or welcome back, as the case may be. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Matthew in Santa Fe, California. California? Santa Fe? Santa Fe Springs?
Santa Fe, New Mexico, Patrick.
My screen, young Thomas, says California. I'll speak to young Thomas about that. Welcome, Matthew.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First time, long time, and all that. So my question is about gun ownership for Catholics. Not for hunting, not for for murder, but for self-defense.
Yeah.
What is the church's teaching on that? And yeah, how do you go about negotiating gun ownership as a Catholic?
Well, I think, number one, we could say that the church respects and teaches that we all have a right to self-defense. In fact, the Catechism talks about your ability to use lethal force if that's what's necessary in a given situation to repel somebody who's trying to kill you. You have that right. And so the way in which you exercise that right could take the form of a fist or a knife or a club or a gun. So the church does not say that you can't own guns. The church doesn't say that you can't use guns if your life is being threatened, for example. Obviously, there's not an unlimited right to use guns. I mean, we have to be respectful and observant of the laws and things. But if it's coming down to owning a gun to defend yourself and your family, in the event that somebody's attacking you with the goal of killing you, you have the right to use the gun, and the church says so.
Okay, I understand. It's just hard to, you know, thinking about, like, for instance, those who live by the sword will die by the sword and all that, and Jesus going quietly and without resistance to his death, you know.
Yeah.
Thinking about those things. And, like, I just can't imagine Christ owning a gun, you know?
Yeah. You know, I don't dispute that, but he also says that, you know, if you don't have a sword, buy a sword. So there, when he gives the instructions to the apostles, so there are, I guess you could say there are different aspects of this issue. And when we look at Jesus, we see that he was not a man of conflict. He was obviously there to suffer and die for our salvation. And I take note of the fact that the early church martyrs, not just the early church martyrs, but those in the early church are a great example, where they didn't take up arms and fight against the Romans. They didn't try to kill the Roman soldiers who came to their door to round them up. They went to their deaths bravely, and they didn't retaliate. So there is definitely that dimension, no doubt about it. And I don't think the discussion would be complete without that. But at the same time, the idea of having a right to self-defense is certainly part of the church's moral teaching. So that too, you know, that too has to be part of the discussion. So that's my take on it.
Okay. Well, thanks for your time, Patrick.
You're welcome. Nice chatting with you. Let's see. Let's go now to Christina in San Marcos, California. Hi, Christina.
Good. Hi. My question is about a college daughter coming home who recently has put pronouns on her signature.
Oh.
And I just want to talk to her about it in a loving way that Catholic.
Yeah.
Still practicing Catholic. The other thing with it is she has two close friends that are in a gender identity that okay. they're dealing with gender issues, gender identity right. issues.
So she's using, well, I'm guessing she's using she, her pronouns?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, she is. Thank goodness.
Right. Well, first of all, you, just between you and me and the who knows how many tens of millions of people who are listening to us right now, it's silly. It's unnecessary. It's all of the above and then some. And you and I know that. But she's living in a world now where everybody does that. Everybody in academia, all, well, maybe not all, but many businesses do this. It's becoming de rigueur, as they say in French, something that's expected. And if you don't do it, people look at you strange or they'll hassle you. How come you're not giving your pronouns? You know, it's just expected that they would do that. So I wouldn't read too much into this because she's conditioned by her surroundings and by all of her peers and all of her professors and people that she sees on social media who do this. It's becoming a very entrenched thing.
Her university is very diverse and liberal, so I know that's where it comes
Well, that's
from.
What I'm saying. That's
I just didn't even know if I should address it. Should I even talk about it?
Why not address it? Why not? I mean, no need to tiptoe around anything like that. You can say, oh, honey, how... I realize that everybody around you is doing that, and it's expected, and it's all over the place, but just be aware. You don't have to do that. It's just silly. Your pronouns are she, her, because you're a woman. And a man's pronouns are he, him, because he's a man. And there is no third option. There is no such thing as a non-binary person. There is no such thing as a, in actual fact, in terms of reality, there is no such thing as a man who becomes a woman or vice versa, or any other option that might occur to somebody. There are men and there are women. Jesus said so. Matthew 19, verse 1, Jesus said, in the beginning, God created them male and female. That's all there is, the binary. Go ahead, Christina. Well, it doesn't sound like my answer is scratching the itch. Go ahead and tell me.
It was perfect. No, that was perfect. But I can hear her saying to me, well, if I take that off, those two friends that she's very close with, one of them is a neighbor in our community. Well, I know it's silly. I don't agree with this, but she's going to say, they're going to take offense. They're going to think that I don't care about them anymore because she's very loving and kind to everyone, no matter, you know, what they identify with or, you know, race. She's just.
That's good.
So what do I say to that?
Yeah, just say, honey, you know, obviously you're not committing a sin if you put these silly pronouns in your social media profile. It's just silly. It's unnecessary. It's dealing with a detachment from reality to kind of play into people's delusions that, gee, I need to tell you what my pronouns are because maybe I'm not really the sex that I obviously am. So it's not that she's doing anything wrong. She is... You know, she is caving into the culture, and I could understand the pressure. Okay. Well, maybe I don't understand because I've never been under that pressure myself. I'm way too old. My college days are so long in the rearview mirror that back in those days, and you're probably not even old enough to remember then, but nobody had any delusions about if you're male or female or something other than that. So I can't personally say I've been through that because I haven't. But I can imagine what it must be like for her. She's probably about 20 years old, and she's in the middle of this gender ideology revolution, and it's all around her, and it's being portrayed as though if you are sensitive and good and kind and loving, you're going to do this because that's what good, sensitive, kind, and loving people do, after all. And if you don't put pronouns, then that means you're homophobic and hateful and probably Christian and so on and so forth. So she's got a tremendous amount of positive peer pressure on the one hand and negative peer pressure if she were to not conform, that's where the negative peer pressure comes in. But here's what I'm driving at, Christina. In your own loving way, why don't you just tell her, listen, if these friendships are based upon whether or not you toe the line and use pronouns in your social media profile, and if this quote-unquote friendship could be so easily damaged because you refrain from putting she, her in your social media profile, is it really a friendship? Is it really an actual friend, or is it just somebody who is nice to you as long as you toe the line? And if so, why would you want to be in a relationship like that?
Okay, that's That's exactly what I would like to say. Okay.
Yeah. I feel for you, Christina.
Okay, thank you.
I do. I mean, none of my kids are going through this that I know of anyway. Probably some of my grandchildren are starting to now, but I want to encourage you, you know, to be loving, obviously, and be patient. We all should be those things. But at the same time, there's no need for us to play games in ways that are detrimental to society. This is why, just one thing, Christina, whenever I'm on social media, if I see somebody who puts pronouns in their social media profile, I have no interest in following that person. I have no
If you interest. Disobey the rules, you get cut off.
Well, that's true.
Well, I'm the same way. Like, I don't. That's me, too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, this was very helpful. It was just mainly with those two friends. She's often thinks that I don't love them. And I'm like, no, they come over to our house. Like, I'm not, they're just nice people. Like, we don't. You can't
try this.
Try this.
I think Christians in general, maybe Catholics in particular, perhaps, have become so sensitive and so worried that other people might get offended. My view is, I'm not going to go out of my way to offend anybody. I will not gratuitously offend you. I will try as hard as I can to be polite and be respectful and all the things I would like people to do for me. But if you're, I don't mean you, Christina, but if you get offended because I don't have he, him in my Twitter profile, away with you. I don't care if you're offended by that. Be offended for all I care. I don't care. And I think more Christians have to grow a thicker skin and say, I am not going to kowtow. I'm not going to bow and scrape and be worried about whether or not people get offended because I don't use their pronoun game. I don't care. And I think the more people start not caring, the more this problem will start to correct itself, I think. I don't know how likely that is.
When you said you don't follow people with that, I don't either. And I was thinking, as a mother, she could be losing out on some very, you know, wonderful friendships or possible, you know, boyfriends or whatever, just because of that pronoun thing. Because of people like us, they would turn away from that. And that, I don't know if I should bring that part of it.
Why
up.
Not? Don't be. Christina, my advice to you is, you're obviously a thoughtful person. I'm sure you're a loving mother. You're gracious and all of the above. But maybe this is an example of what I mean. People need to stop worrying about other people being offended. If someone gets offended and there's no reason for them to be offended because you didn't do anything wrong, well, that's on them. It's not on you. It's not your fault. And life's too short for us to go around worrying and wringing our hands and looking over our shoulders and thinking, am I offending somebody
okay.
because I'm not playing their game? No. Life's too short.
All right, this is wonderful.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Christina. Thank you. And thank you, Christina. And just FYI, everybody, I'm not suggesting that you be gratuitously insulting. Far from it. I believe strongly in all the reasons why you should be polite and respectful and charitable and all of the above. I'm not advocating brutality or harshness or any of those things at all. The crazy thing is that people will ascribe those things to you if you don't use pronouns or if you don't buy into this or go along with this. That's on them. If you're a good person trying to be polite, trying to be respectful and all that, and you just don't play the game, that's on that person, not on you. Let's go to Mary now in Belvedere, Illinois. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So my niece was baptized Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
About 10 years ago, her whole family converted to the Protestant church. Mm-hmm. And her father, my brother-in-law, is now a Protestant pastor. And she's getting married through the Protestant church, and we were invited, but I don't believe that it would be correct for us to attend, but I'm not sure.
Let me ask you a couple questions that will help me get a sense of this. So the niece who's getting married, was she ever a Catholic, or was she raised in this Protestant church that her parents went into?
No, she was a Catholic, baptized, and I believe First Communion, but then about 10 years ago, the whole family converted.
And how old was she when she left?
Probably around 12.
Okay, so this is not her fault. She was taken out of the Catholic Church by her parents, and she had no say in the matter. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So the question here is this marriage going to be valid? And understand this, that the church's law stipulates that in order for a Catholic, we're talking about a baptized Catholic who has received the sacraments of initiation, she's received two, the Holy Eucharist, well, baptism and the Holy Eucharist. It's unknown, I guess, whether or not she received her sacrament of confirmation. If she had received that, then she would be fully initiated. But in any case, she's received at least two of the sacraments of initiation. So strictly speaking, the church says that in order for a Catholic in that situation to have a valid marriage, it's necessary to follow what's called the canonical form, meaning with a few other details here, the core would be that you get married in a Catholic church and the minister who is presiding is either a deacon, more likely it would be a priest, or it could be a bishop. And if those things are not there, if those ingredients are not present, and there was no dispensation given by the bishop, then it would be objectively considered an invalid marriage. So that's the church's law on that topic. Okay. The difference here, though, is that she was a child. Now, we can say that her parents bear the guilt from departing from the Catholic Church, and so that's a separate issue there. But she herself as a child did not have a say in the matter, and so this is where there's a bit of a gray area here, because I don't know, and this is where I would need to maybe consult a canon lawyer. Perhaps you could do the same thing in your own diocese. Consult a canon lawyer and just say, in the case of a child who, as a child, received at least a couple of the sacraments of initiation, but then was whisked away into a Protestant church, and that's where she grew up, and she never really was a Catholic beyond 12 years old. In a case like that, does the church's law say that she would be invalidly married if she got married in the Protestant church? That's an interesting question I've never sought an answer to, because I don't know what the church would say on that. So maybe you can check in with your diocese and ask if the marriage tribunal could answer this question for you. And if there's a nuance there, leading up to your question here, if there's a nuance there that would say, in the case of a child who's been taken out of the Catholic Church, this would not apply. Therefore, you would not be doing anything problematic if you attended that wedding, which is, I'm sure, the answer you'd like to get.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to attend, but I also want to do the right thing. You know, I don't want to, give the wrong message, you know, by attending.
Right. And you love her and want to support her, and none of this is her fault. That's correct. The key to the whole thing, if you ask me.
Yes, I agree, 100%. Yeah.
So check with your diocese and ask to speak to the marriage tribunal, somebody there, and then pose this question and see what response you get. And if you think of it, maybe call me back or send me an email. I'd be interested in knowing what they say.
Okay, Patrick. Thank you so much for your time.
You got it. Thank you. Break time, and we will come right back with more. We have one line open. That's not going to last long. So if you want it, call now. If you want it, here it is. Come and get it. But you better hurry, because it may not last. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Follow Patrick on Twitter at Patrick Madrid.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
1, 2, 3, 4.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
All right, let's get back to it. 888-914-9149. Ken Hensley did such a great job filling in for me yesterday. I was able to listen to some of it. I was in transit. So thanks, Ken. Great job. And people really like what Ken does. The exposition of Scripture and explaining things like baptismal regeneration and all of those good things.
Fact.
Yeah. And he gets fan mail now, too, from what I understand.
Isn't that cool? Better watch out. He's coming for you.
No way, man. Well, I better. I have to up my game.
Yep.
All right.
Some friendly competition.
Yeah, bring it. Bring it on. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Emily in Sacramento. Hi, Emily.
Hi. I was actually calling because I didn't know it's like the reindeer had any kind of symbolic meaning in the Bible or if it had anything to do with the lamb.
No, I don't think so. In fact, to my knowledge, reindeer as a species are not mentioned in the Bible. Deer are, but not reindeer that I know of. So I don't think there is any special significance to them in the Bible. Now, are you talking about Christmas or the Bible per se?
Probably Christmas, like where they kind of got it from, because I wasn't really sure if it has to do with because Jesus had his lambs or if it was like, yeah, I wasn't sure.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about the animals that we see depicted in the nativity scenes is that that comes from tradition. So the ox and the, or the cow, as you might say, and the donkey, there is an old tradition that has them there. And it also, if you'll notice, many of the nativity scenes show a cross on the backs of either or both of those two animals. Now, that's not from the Bible, but the tradition that they were there comes down in an oral way outside of the Bible. And the lambs, and we can assume that there were lambs there too because the shepherds came and visited. So maybe there weren't lambs there to begin with, but when the shepherds came, we would think that some of them brought their sheep with them. So that's another reason why we see those there. But the reindeer themselves, no, that would be something that was interpolated long after that.
He's got a shiny nose.
That's just Cyrus. Don't worry about him.
His beak blinks like a blinking beacon.
He doesn't mean any harm, Emily. That's just Cyrus.
Well, thank you very much. I know it's kind of a silly question, but I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you. Appreciate that. Let's go to Evan now. 12 years old, I'm told, in Santa Fe, Texas. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Mr. Madrid. I'm conflicted.
Okay.
Jesus said these words to Didymus, the good thief.
Yeah.
Amen, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise.
Right.
But we proclaim in the Apostles' Creed, he descended into hell. And on the third day, he rose again from the dead.
Right.
So, Mr. Madrid, tell me this. How did Didymus and Jesus get to heaven on the same day that Jesus died?
Excellent question, Evan. You are going to make a fine prosecuting attorney someday, or maybe a radio host, or maybe something else, but you have a sharp mind. Has anyone ever told you that?
No, Mr. Madrid.
All right. Well, I'll be the first to say so. Very good, astute question. So the answer to the question is that in this case, paradise does not refer to heaven. Paradise refers to the place in the underworld, Sheol in Hebrew, Hades in Greek, hell in its archaic form in the Creed in English. But it was the place of the underworld where all the souls of everybody who died would go, and some went to a place of punishment, and some went to a place of peace and tranquility. And that place of peace and tranquility was known as paradise. It had other names. The limbo of the fathers was another name. So in Luke 16, when Jesus tells us the story of Lazarus and the rich man, you see this underworld and you see that the rich man went to the place of punishment and Lazarus, the poor man, went to the place of peace with Abraham and the other righteous people of the Old Testament. And that place where they were in the underworld was known as paradise. So on the cross, when Jesus said to the good thief, St. Didymus, and it's nice that you know his traditional name. We're not given that name in Scripture, but that's the name that tradition gives to him. And he says, I tell you, this day you will be with me in paradise. That means that after Jesus died, and shortly after that, when they broke the legs of the two thieves and they died, St. Dismas went down to that part of Sheol where the righteous people of the Old Testament were waiting, known as paradise. Jesus went there, preached the gospel to all of them, and brought all of them with him up to heaven. So that's why there's no contradiction, no conflict between what Jesus said and where they went. Does that make more sense to you?
Yeah, I have two other questions.
Sure. You've earned it. Okay. You've earned two more questions, Evan. Go ahead.
Thank you. My brother and I have been arguing about this for a while. Okay, who would be classified as the first saint, St. Dismas or Elijah? Because the Bible clearly states, as they walked on conversing, a flaming chariot and flaming horses came between them, and Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Mm-hmm. Would Elijah be the first saint, or would Dismas?
Neither one, as a matter of fact. Now, that's another astute question, because you see there that when Elisha saw Elijah taken up in the fiery chariot, he was taken up into the heavens. But that doesn't mean that he went to heaven, because the gates of heaven were still closed. So Elijah went to this place where Jesus went with St. Dismas and gathered up all the righteous of the Old Testament. So he was caught up into the heavens, meaning up into the sky, but not into heaven proper. So neither of them would be the first saint, meaning like who was the first person to enter heaven? That's a hard question to answer. We don't know if it was, you know, I don't think it was like, okay, Adam and Eve, you get to go in first, and then we'll let Abel go in, and then we'll let Methuselah go in, and then we'll let Noah go in, and then we'll let Abraham go in. I don't think it was like that. I think it was like, everybody went in all at once. Jesus brought all of them into heaven. So in terms of like a timestamp, who went to heaven first, I don't think we could say that any particular person did. So we could say that they all became saints in the highest sense of the word all at once when they all entered into the beatific vision. That'd be the closest I could come to an answer on that one, Evan.
Okay, thank you.
Did you have another question or are we done?
Oh, my other question was, where did Elijah and Enoch go if Jesus was the first one to open the gates of heaven?
And now you know. And you can answer that question now, can't you?
Yes, sir, I can.
That's great. Well, I have to give credit to your parents. It sounds like they're doing an awesome job of raising you and your siblings. You're doing well in your thought process. Pass along my kind regards to them, please.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Evan. Great talking to you. How about George now in Helena, Montana? Good morning, George.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a quick question. Is it okay for a transsexual to be a Eucharistic minister at Mass?
I don't think so, because this is an activity, a lifestyle that is contrary to the Church's teaching on, among other things, on our sexual identity as male and female. And so this is a pastoral issue that obviously, you know, in a given situation, the pastor has to be tactful and he has to be pastoral. But the problem is if you have somebody who's distributing Holy Communion, who's by virtue of his public appearance is showing that he's not living in accordance with the Church's teaching on some issue, that is a cause of scandal and a cause of confusion. I mean, look at you. You're calling in to ask about that. So from a pastoral standpoint, it's not appropriate to ask somebody to assist. Well, let me just say, it's not appropriate to ask somebody to assist with the distribution of Holy Communion if that person is publicly known to be doing something contrary to the Church's moral teaching. In the same way that, let's say that this was not a trans person, a transsexual, let's just say this was a known adulterer, and everybody knows that this person is living in the state of adultery or some other scandalous sin, it would be pastorally wrong for him to be asked to distribute Holy Communion because it's clearly scandalous to the people who see this. The Church says that if you want to participate in a ministry in the Church, that presupposes that you're trying to live a life in accordance with the teachings of the church and the gospel of Jesus. And if you're intentionally not doing that, then until you get your house in order, you really shouldn't be involved in ministry because of the scandal that it gives.
Well, do you think I should try to make it known to any, like the priest?
Well, you can ask him a question. Father, this seems incongruous to me. I don't understand what's going on here. Could you please enlighten me? I mean, I don't know, obviously, because I'm not there, but I don't know how that will go over. But it's a reasonable question. The church's canon law itself specifies in canon, what is it? Let me think which canon that is. The church's own law itself, it's canon 212, if you're interested, canon 212, that says that the faithful have the right and sometimes even the obligation to speak up about what they perceive to be a problem in the church. They have that right to speak up and speak out about that. And so this may be that kind of a scenario. I mean, I would discuss it quietly with the priest, if that's possible. If you don't
okay,
get...
Well,
go ahead, George.
Well, thank you, Patrick. I went yesterday, and I have inside knowledge of this, and I went to a different line, but just looking at this girl, mm-hmm. you would think she's a boy.
Yeah.
But
well, we have to be, and I'm sure you are, but we have to be compassionate. We have to be kind. We have to be charitable to all people, including people who are in the throes of a gender dysphoria issue. So I'm not advocating in any way that we should be cruel or unkind or anything. But at the same time, when you're in that position and you're distributing Holy Communion or you're lecturing or you're doing something else in a quasi-official capacity in a kind of ministry in the church, it's different because, I mean, let me change it around. Let's say it was some other kind of sin. Let's say that it was somebody who is publicly known for some other kind of sin, whatever it may be. Would it be appropriate to ask that person to be distributing Holy Communion if it was known that this person engaged in scandalous behavior? I think that anyone's going to say, well, no, it's not appropriate. So this is just one right. of those examples. We don't want to shun anybody. We don't want to exclude people. We don't want to turn anyone away. We're not saying you can't come to Mass. None of those things, because Jesus died for all of us. Jesus came to save sinners. So on the one hand, I'm not suggesting that we do anything to kind of shun this person or make him feel unwanted or you can't come in here or you can't be at Mass. Not at all. It should be exactly the opposite. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean that you therefore have the right to participate in these public ways if your lifestyle says that you're not living according to the gospel. Whatever your reasons may be, only God knows. But it's incongruous and it's scandalous and it causes confusion.
Well, it did with me, Patrick, and it makes me feel like, hey, look, God made a mistake with me and I'm going to give you communion. Well, I went to the other line, but I felt very uncomfortable.
Well, you can do that. There's nothing stopping you from doing that. It's not as though, let's just say that you did receive Holy Communion from the hand of this person. That in no way diminishes the spiritual fruitfulness of the Holy Communion for you. It doesn't change the validity of the Eucharist. None of those things are affected if you were to receive Holy Communion from somebody like that. Or somebody else doing something else egregious and you receive Holy Communion. It doesn't change the reality of what's happening for you, but this is where Jesus talks about scandal and scandalizing people and the seriousness of causing scandal and why you shouldn't cause scandal. That's what that's dealing with. But if you felt like, gee, I'm just feeling uncomfortable, you shouldn't worry that if you received Holy Communion from somebody who is doing something like that, it doesn't affect the communion for you. You see what I'm saying? It doesn't invalidate it
yes.
or anything like that.
Yes, I do. Well, thank you so much, Patrick.
You're welcome, George. I understand. Thank you. And perhaps, a thoughtful conversation with the parish priest might bear some good fruit. You never know. Thank you. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. I'm amazed at how quickly the time is going by, but there's still time for you if you call in 888-914-9149. I have two lines open, but the lines are blinking. They may be gone in moments. So call now, 888-914-9149. Today, we'd like to thank Stella, who's listening in California, for donating her Oldsmobile. Join thousands of other listeners in donating old vehicles by visiting relevantradio.com/car today.
We were four guys. We were just a band who made it very, very big, that's all.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We're back, as you could probably tell, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Darren now in San Antonio. Hello, Darren. Welcome.
Patrick, thank you. I have two questions. One was brought up while I was on hold. You talked about pronouns on social media not being kind of inherently sinful. I was just wondering, when you also mentioned scandal, if you're a devout Catholic and you were to do something like that, would that scandal not be considered?
I don't think that would be scandalous.
Putting it there is okay?
Yeah, I don't think so. Here's why, because as I was saying earlier, for lack of a better term, it's silly to put your pronouns in a social media profile as an example. It's silly. It's unnecessary. It feeds into, and maybe this is where you're asking your question, it feeds into this delusion that you can be something other than what God created you to be, male or female. But in itself, I don't think it rises to the level of scandal. I think it's you know, I'm going to go along to get along. That's not great, but it's not sinful. It's not intrinsically wrong to do that. So that's where I would draw the line. And I think it's rather far on the other side of the line that it doesn't even really approach the area, the level of scandal. To my mind, it would show a kind of weakness of character that if somebody feels like, well, I better put my pronouns in my profile, that kind of a weakness of character, that you're afraid of standing up for what's true, or you just want to keep your head down and not get your head shot off, things like that. But I would not regard it as sinful. Therefore, I don't see it as scandalous per se.
Okay, well, thank you for that clarification. And then the real reason I was calling, when I listen to a lot of Catholic radio, a lot of the guest speakers and hosts speak of having a spiritual advisor. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering your thoughts on the laity having access to spiritual advisors beyond things like Relevant Radio. Mm-hmm. Ways of getting access to that, is that something that all lay Catholics should be looking for in some way, shape, or form in their faith walk? Just these really devout people seem to all have this in common, but I don't hear it offered or spoken about much. I just don't know how that process works for people.
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, a spiritual director might be a term that you would hear more commonly, and that is somebody who typically it would be a priest, and I would advocate that it should be a priest, even though there are people who are not priests who do have that title as spiritual director. I think that spiritual direction in the fullest sense should include, whenever possible, the sacrament of confession, and of course only a priest can do that. Deacons can't do that. Religious sisters can't do that. Radio hosts cannot do that. That's something that's unique to the priesthood. So if you want a spiritual director who's going to be able to kind of complete the circle of spiritual direction, concluding with the sacrament of confession or reconciliation, I would encourage finding a good, knowledgeable, experienced, and virtuous priest who could do that. Now, it's not always possible, but it's a lot more likely, a lot more possible than I think many people realize. So for you, if you're interested in doing that, I would suggest just, you know, maybe a priest that you know from your parish or in the area, and just ask him, would you be in a position to give spiritual direction, you know, say an hour a month? Would that be part of, you know, your ministry? Would you be able to do that? And in my experience in the past, priests generally are happy to do that if they have the time to do it.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that insight. I will definitely, prayerfully take that into consideration and likely do it. So.
Yeah. Let me give you one quick. Sure. Yeah. Let me give you one quick resource. If you go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, you will see links. So it has contact and links. If you click on the links button, then you can go to my website, and I have an article there on what are some of the important characteristics to look for in a spiritual director. And I offer my own thoughts, and then I segue into more important thoughts from a priest who was a spiritual director. His name is Father Jordan Ammann, a Dominican friar. And his book, Spiritual Theology, is in its entirety available online in PDF form. And so I link to that book so you can go directly to what he has to say. But he's got a lengthy section in there on the things that you should look for in a good spiritual director. So that's free if you're interested. And we'll get a link to that for you also so you can check it out if you go to the show Twitter feed at @PMadridShow or go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. You'll see it there as well.
Beautiful. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Have a blessed day and a happy Advent. Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Darren. Thank you. It's hard to believe, Cyrus, but we're just about at Christmas. It's right around the corner, isn't it?
I can't believe it. You got your Christmas shopping done?
Nancy does our Christmas shopping.
Bless her heart.
Yeah, she does such a great job. I would just get in the way.
I know the feeling.
Do you have your Christmas shopping done?
No.
I didn't think so.
No.
Didn't think so. Let's go to Susan in New Jersey. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning. I was wondering about the baptism in the Latin rite versus the regular. I don't mean versus, but what's the difference between not the actual baptism, but all the prayers around it? Has anyone done any comparison?
Now, do you mean between the traditional rite in what we think of as the Latin Mass versus the new rite? Okay. Well, obviously, essentially, it's the same sacrament. It can't be different one from the other. But the older form of the sacrament included. Now, let me pause here. In the new rite of the Mass, the sacraments as they were promulgated since Vatican II, in the case of the new rite of baptism, it includes virtually all, if not all, or at least most of, the elements of the pre-Vatican II baptismal rite, if it's celebrated that way. Now, there is a shorter form, and I think in most parishes it probably follows the shorter form. But the longer form that I have seen celebrated in a Novus Ordo parish, if we want to call it that, includes, for example, the exorcism of the water. That was part of the traditional rite, was in the priest performs an actual exorcism on the water. And there are many prayers and preparations for the sacrament of baptism, including the anointing with oil and such. Those things are present even still in the new rite of baptism, but often an abbreviated version of the rite is what's celebrated. So to the extent that the new rite of baptism is celebrated in its fullness with all of those aspects, it would be very close to the way it was celebrated in the traditional rite, with very few things that would be different. If you're talking about the abbreviated version in the new rite, then you would see a lot less than you would see in a traditional baptism, traditional meaning the traditional Latin Mass form. Does that answer your question?
But most people are not aware of the long and short versions.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I'm wondering is, when someone has a baby, I mean, usually they want the full shebang for their baby. Mm-hmm. You know, they want all the, you know, exorcism of the ears and the, you know, whatever they do where they dip the finger in their mm-hmm. baby's mouth and exorcise the mouth and all those things. Because, you know, if there's things in the family line or the parents are very sinful, doesn't that protect the baby more?
Well, I don't know if I'd put it that way, because remember that the sacrament itself is the power that is being worked there. So all those things that lead up to the baptism itself, they're beautiful and they're rightfully part of the church's patrimony in this celebration of the sacrament. But the real point of the sacrament is the eradication of sin, the removal of the condition of original sin, all the effects of sin, the infusion of grace, all of that takes place with the sacrament itself, even if none of those other things took place, even if none of the blessings or exorcisms or any of those other things took place, the power of the sacrament still obtains, regardless. And that's the key to the whole thing. The other things are beautiful, and they're helpful insofar as they show forth the power of Christ over the evil one, and such, but they're not, strictly speaking, necessary for the sacrament to do what it does in its fullness.
Okay. Well, I mean, I do ask the question, why did they do them?
Well, because it was a fuller way of expressing the reality of what's taking place. So you could have, let's put it this way, let's compare it to a different sacrament. So let's compare it to the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist. So under ordinary circumstances, the Mass itself is replete with many different dimensions. So you have the Liturgy of the Word, the Liturgy of the Eucharist. You have all the various prayers. You have the penitential rite. On Sundays, we recite the Creed. So many things that are packed into 1 hour of the Mass. And that's the normative way of doing it, because all of those elements contribute to you as the person who's there at Mass, to elevating your thoughts and your mind and your heart to God and the things of God, and preparing you all the more to receive the sacrament and all of the above. But if a priest were in a prison cell somewhere and he had no vestments, he had no candles, he had no sacramentary from which he could read the prayers of the Mass, if he had bread and wine, he could celebrate Mass in a dank, dreary prison cell, and it would be just as full and just as efficacious and spiritually fruitful if he celebrated Mass with just the bare minimum to consecrate the bread and the wine. It would still be the Mass in all its fullness and all of its power. But obviously it's preferable by far to celebrate the Mass in the ordinary way. And I would draw that comparison with baptism. It still has the full effect, the full power, and the full change that takes place, whether it's celebrated in the rite with all of the accoutrements, or if it's just baptism on the pavement next to a car accident in the middle of the night.
Okay. So, like, let's just say a parent is very sinful and they're, like, in mortal sin, and they get their child baptized.
Yes.
Isn't the child, if the child, you know, eventually goes under mortal sin, aren't they more inclined to do the sin of the parent? And then I guess I was thinking that if there's some kind of exorcism before the baptism or during the baptism, that the child would be less inclined, or the child wouldn't have that propensity because of the parent or something like that. I mean, I don't know if where I'm getting that from exactly, but
I don't think so. I don't think there's a one-to-one cause and effect between those two, because remember that those things take place prior to the baptism itself. At least some of those things, not all of those things. Some of those aspects of the old rite, or the fuller rite, take place before the baptism itself. So, the power and the effects of the baptism are what matter, and I don't see, this is where we have to be careful not to lapse into a kind of superstition that, this baby didn't receive all of the aspects of the fuller rite of baptism, therefore this child is at greater risk somehow, or that this child is now under some cloud or something, some vulnerability that the child who received all of those things isn't under. I don't think we should look at it that way. The church doesn't propose that to us, that if you...
Okay.
Go ahead.
I just think it's interesting because I wasn't sure, but when you said that that they do those exorcisms before the baptism, even that I find interesting. Like,
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm very happy with what you're telling me, but I also think there's something that it seems like they did it for a reason, and I guess I would like that for mine.
Yeah, so I hear you. And the reason that they do that is because it fully expresses all the aspects of what's taking place in baptism. But absent those those other parts of it, it doesn't in any way diminish the power and the effects of baptism. If you scooped up some water out of a stream and baptized somebody, it has the same power and effects. Thanks, Susan. Great question. I'll be right back.